Our last speaker I'd like to introduce is Cyril Kaminad from the University of Liverpool, who was talking about the impacts of climate change on vector-borne diseases.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for having me. It's quite an honor to be at Collège de France today with you all. So I've got this honor to keep you entertained just before lunch. Everybody's hungry now and wants to eat something. I'm going to talk about one of those horsemen, so pestilence in that case, and talking back to vector-borne diseases, or diseases transmitted by insects mostly. So I think you've seen things from a talk, so there's going to be some repeats, but just to clarify things for non-specialists, a vector-borne disease needs three components. So you're going to need a pathogen, it can be a bacteria, parasite, or virus. People have been discussing that, different beasts. Different hosts, knowing that you can have different hosts involved in the system. You can have intermediate hosts, final hosts, depending on the disease you're looking at, and a vector. And the vector, mostly an arthropod is an ectotherm. So when it's an ectotherm, it means its temperature equals air temperature. It's not like us, like mammals, where we got like 37°C thermoregulated host. So obviously, temperature of insects mostly equals air temperature. So you start seeing, you can see things coming there. Different hosts, humans, animals, and plants, we're all affected by those vector-borne diseases. We've been talking mostly about humans and animals. I think Natalie's been talking about that too. There's also the plants. Plants are affected by diseases. They're affected by aphids, transmitted viruses, etc., etc. So it's everything that is affected by those diseases. Just one example here for malaria comes from the Italian bad air. In French, we used to say paludisme because it was close to the close to the swamps. Pathogen here is a parasite, mostly Plasmodium falciparum. That's the tropical version, which is going to be prevalent in Africa. Plasmodium vivax used to be more temperate, extending into Europe even in the past. The host affected by this one is going to be a human being, Homo sapiens. And the vector, I've just shown one very nasty here, Anopheles gambiae, which is the most common vector in Africa, transmitting malaria. There are several others. And depending on where you are, they're going to have different efficiency at transmitting this pathogen. So you need those three conditions, a host, pathogens, vectors, everything evolving into the environment. Malaria is mostly an African problem nowadays. It used to affect far more people back in the days, but now it's mostly affecting Africa because there's been big progress with modern medicine, something to keep in mind. It's not all gloom and doom. We've got tools to fight diseases. We've got modern medicine. And are still, nowadays, large impacts on the economics, the training, soldiers, everything. So if we get back to the impact of those vector-borne diseases across history, they're quite evident. I think there's been some people talking about history before, the plague of Justinians, the Black Death, etc. So it's quite, they always had an impact, those diseases, even if they're mediated by human system. Plague, second pandemic, wiped out between, we think, a third and a half of the European population back in the days. Big impact. Such an impact, it killed all the farmers. As it killed all the farmers, vegetation grew back, and even CO2. CO2 was pumped afterwards. So it's quite crazy, the feedback you can have from those diseases. You can basically wipe humans and make the vegetation grow again. Malaria still killed too many people in Africa. I already talked about that. Zika, so you remember those pictures, terrible pictures with babies with microcephaly, which is a vector-borne disease transmitted mostly by Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, affected the health of Latin Americans and other regions in the globe in 2015, 2016. Problems that shouldn't be an issue, like yellow fever. We got 100% efficient vaccine for yellow fever, but if you cannot give the vaccines to those in need, it's pointless, obviously, and you can start having new hotspots of yellow fever in those countries. So there's been some re-emergence in Africa, Angola, and DRC during the same period. Zika was basically hammering us. Another example people don't think about, but we start having transmission of those tropical exotic diseases into Europe. So there was a very minor, let's say, chikungunya outbreak that occurred in the province of Ravenna in Italia in 2006, and that's basically the data I'm showing here. There's been some minor cases of local autochthonous transmission of dengue and Zika in France, in the southeast, in Paca, in Rhône-Alpes, and same in Italy and same in Croatia across the coast. So it's happening. And blue tongue, so it's not only us, it's also our animals. Everything is kind of connected. Animal can get sick. If they get sick, you have to kill them, and the livestock sector, the farmers, have to pay a price. There was a large outbreak of blue tongue in Northern Europe in 2006, one of the examples here. And this occurred during a heat wave that hit Northern Europe. Costed about $150 million to $100 million just for the Netherlands at the time. So to recap, I get back to my triptych. And we expect climate to impact those diseases for several good reasons. First, rainfall is going to make breeding sites, ponds, but humans can also create breeding sites. You forget a shoe in your garden, you irrigate your garden, the shoe is full of water. That's a breeding site potentially for some mosquitoes. Temperature is going to affect the growth, development, mortality of all species on the planet. So it's always going to be a U-shape. Some people are going to talk about heat and mortality later on the sessions, but it's the same for everyone. Basically, if you parachuted into the Sahara with nothing, you won't survive very long. If you parachuted into Antarctica with nothing, you won't survive very long either. And it's the same for all species on the planet. And they're going to be more or less adaptable, depending on the species you're looking at. Trying to make it simple. So to make it very simple, because it can be more complicated, we can summarize sometimes the potential of an insect to transmit a disease by this variable that we call vectorial capacity in EP, which depends on the temperature. So that's an example from Ken Laferty and Mordecai back in 2016, I think. That shows you a typical curve for, I think, a tropical disease like malaria in the paper. Basically, if it's too cold, you don't have any risk. If it's too warm, risk disappears, and there's an optimum that's going to be more or less in warm temperature for a tropical disease, hence why we call them tropical diseases in the first instance. So the problem with climate change is very simple. Let's say you live in this area, and then you increase the temperature by a few degrees, okay? Just a tiny increase, 1-2 degrees. Global scale can mean a lot regionally. It could be 4 or 5, depending where you are. So you can move from a region where nothing happens to something happens. That's number one. But then, conversely, on the other hand, if it gets too warm in the warm regions, you can have also benefits from climate change. It means that it could wipe out the plague, and I think Chris showed a hint just before, and I'm going to talk about that later in the talk. So it's not climate change makes everything worse. Climate change makes things worse. In some places, might make it better, depending, but we're going to have to be very vigilant. And then, because if you wipe out malaria, as Chris well said, it's one less problem, but that's going to be a problem for water resources, agriculture, and other things, which are even more important. So that kept me busy over the years across the University of Liverpool in the UK with several colleagues and ICTP. Back to the parameters affected by climate. I'm going to try to be a bit be a bit faster here. There are several parameters that we know are impacted by temperature. It's thing that we saw in the field. Field entomology has been showing that in the lab by doing experiments in the lab. So it's not modeling there. It's pure field observation type based studies. So we know that the biting rate, so when it gets warmer, usually, they tend to bite more. That's an example for the yellow fever mosquito, Aedes aegypti, that can transmit dengue, Zika, and yellow fever. And you can see that this potential increases as the temperature increases, up to a certain limit. Okay, well that's over-dispersed here, the points. You can argue about the fits, but that's a fact. Fact number two. As I said before, if you get parachuted in the Sahara or the Antarctic, you won't survive very long. If it's too warm, if it's too cold, same for mosquitoes. An example for the tropical species, Aedes aegypti on the left, so the yellow fever mosquito, which is very lookalike of the Asian tiger mosquito that you now find in France. I'll get back to that later. On the right-hand side, you can see on top, it's estimates done in the lab, okay, what you can do in a lab when you're a scientist, or things estimated from the field. So first thing you can see is one is quite tropical, quite like it when it's warm, one is a bit more plastic, and also you got very big differences between what you find in your lab and what you find in the field. So always be careful when you do your experiments before you extrapolate anything. So too warm they die, too cold they die, and they got obviously their own specificity. They like it moist sometimes they like it a bit colder, and I think Nathalie showed that for three very distinct species of tick that show you a big range of differences within a single, just for a single vector, tick. That's several species. Most important point, I think, that's something we need to remember. The way they get infectious, so the time required for the pathogen to replicate inside the mosquito vector. So there's lots of work done in Pasteur here in Paris by Annabella Fayouf, for example, doing those experiments. There are others doing the same thing in America. If it gets warmer, they get infectious faster. So that's an example here for Anopheles stephensi. It's one of the most common Indian mosquito vector for malaria and Plasmodium falciparum, we talked about before. So if it gets 20 degrees, it's going to take about, let's say, 2 weeks for, I think, 20% of the population that was tested in that sample to get infectious. But if you increase the temperature in your incubators to 44 C, you'll see that you shrink it about a week. So it goes like, you've got like a factor two times of speed. Okay, so it gets warmer, they get infectious faster, so when they bite you, they can potentially transmit you a disease. Okay, so that's very important. So when you try to combine all those numbers all together, there's lots of things you can do. I could spend an hour here talking about this slide, but there's different schools, but they tend to interact. So the old school, let's say ecological, purely epidemiological modeling school, when you try to model the risk of particular diseases, mostly statistical. We have now new fancy machine learning techniques. What do? You got sets of observations, so you know where things are, you know where a mosquito is, or you know where a pathogen occurred, or it hit us in the past. You look at different predictors that you think are connected to this outcome. They could be climatic, they could be also vulnerability estimates, population density estimates, proximity to rivers, so there's lots of things you can do with that. And then you're going to build some kind of a fit or a statistical model that tends to explain the outcome. We're like trying to explain the variance of the outcome. And you project the map, you extrapolate the risk to other regions. That's step one. So you do that with observations, the best data you can get. And then you say, OK, this is where we think things are based on this extrapolation. But then after you can, what I've been doing in many years and others been doing, you can also take the climate scenarios from the IPCC, playing with those climate models, and use those outputs to drive the risk into the future, looking at the far future and different emission scenarios from the most optimistic that we can forget, I think, now, to the most pessimistic. And then you drive your model with those scenarios, and you try to see how it looks like into the future. Here an example for Europe. So that's the statistical, let's say, machine learning type technique. But then you've got something more mechanistic that I've shown you before, which is derived from the Ronald Ross McDonald framework. You all know about Arno now with COVID, so it's the basic reproduction number. So everybody knows about that now with COVID, it's in the news. So it's the number of secondary cases arising from a primary infection in a totally fully susceptible population. And there's a version for vector-borne disease. That relies on temperature, and the parameters I've talked about before, like biting rate, EIP, and mortality, are all combined together to produce these kind of suitability curves that you can integrate, validate with data, then use scenarios and project the risk into the future. So there's some similarities, and sometimes the methods overlap. You could get like one covariate from here to put into there, depending on how many variables you got, how continuous they are, what you can get or not, because some data sets are unknown. There's things you don't know. So that's it. I think I'm not going to go very far on that. It's been talked about a lot in the past in the former presentations, but basically climate is just one thing, or weather, which sets the background, let's say, for transmission or for the presence of an host, but there's so many parameters. There's lots of parameters you need to consider. And the way we use our land, I think, is very critical. The way we occupy the space is key, and you saw it with interaction between bats and humans recently. And the way we move things as well. And plus all the weapons we got to fight diseases, modern medicine, etc. So which led to this, I think, One Health framework that you've all heard about, which is basically how health is connected to the health of our animals, but also to the environment. We're all connected. One thing collapses. If we collapse, the rest will carry on. But yeah, you collapse there, or you remove that, we're all dead, basically. So I'm going to talk about A few research examples now. So last time I was invited in Paris, and last time I saw Patrick, actually, that was for a conference invited by Sylvie Joussomme for GIS Climate. And then I was showing those slides. I was in 2012, so it's been 10 years since, long time ago. And we developed a very simple, or compare different models for the risk posed by Aedes albopictus in Europe. So the tiger, Asian tiger, mosquito. Based on simple annual beans with like some other entering criteria for winter temperature, simple things. What did I say last time I came here? I said basically the thing could go, that was the situation bottom left, observations back into June 2011 when I came to Paris to talk about it. That's the model we were looking at, and that's what's going on now, okay, March 2022 more or less, so recently, let's say. So what did I say? I say basically two or three things based on those projections that goes into time, as you can see here. They're very granular. It's a model. It's not perfect, but it can be useful. I'm going to quote box again. What can we see? It's basically, A, you could see that the mosquito didn't fill its niche potentially, theoretically, just based on those covariates. So basically it could go over a wide region, over France, and I was saying basically to Sylvie and the others in the room, the thing could do a V-shape with like a big spot, you could have hot spots in Paris or some, let's say, urban spaces. Very bad also in PACA and Rhône-Alpes and over Bordeaux. But at the time it was just there, it was just in PACA, just in Italy mostly, and going a bit down in Spain, okay? But then, okay, we are not exactly right, yeah? Okay, because in Portugal we were overestimating the risk, in Spain perhaps underestimating in some places. So it's not perfect everywhere, but the trend is not that stupid. Even the hotspots we had in Germany, here by the border, in the end, were quite correct. So those models are useful. You can project them into the future. They're not going to be perfect, but they can give you some good hints, I think. And I had to have lots of fights and things to argue at the time, but in fact, I'm afraid we were correct, and I don't like being correct. I like being wrong. So if I just could be wrong, I'd be very happy. I was just like, I got it wrong, it's fine. Out of the list, that's the list of papers we had in the paper back in the days. I highlighted in red where the mosquito is now established. In orange, I think when they've been spotted, but not yet established. So I just got Cyprus wrong for the minute. Sorry for the Cypriot. Another paper. So building a more complicated RNO model, so based on two vectors for Aedes aegypti, Aedes albopictus, humans mediated by temperature for Zika at the time of the pandemic, so we're all rushing to publish and say something clever about Zika, hopefully. What did we do? We basically drove that model, but with a very simple model using rainfall temperature and some kind of human population density estimates in it. We showed that there was a big anomaly in 2015, when the epidemic did occur. So theoretically, okay, the climate was exceptionally suitable for the transmission of Zika virus in South America that year. And we know there's not only us, I mean, there's been other teams working on that showing similar things, and in the past even showing connection with dengue outbreaks, because dengue is a different pathogen, it's a different virus, but it's transmitted by the same mosquito. Okay, so, and this connection between El Nino, which is this warming of the Pacific, and let's say the spread of disease all across the tropics, it's well known in the literature. There's a lot on this, if you are not a specialist. So that's one thing. Back to malaria, so we had some of those scenarios, and it's what Chris was saying just before. I'm just going to comment the worst case scenario here, bottom right, so it's for the most extreme, let's say semi-5, so the former exercise, IPCC scenario of the 2080s, changes in the length of the transmission season. So, you know, if you got epidemic behavior, the transmission season is going to be very short. And if you got an endemic behavior of a disease, the season is going to be very long. So basically, you can get the disease all year long, if you know about that. And it's just a change here, so where things change. So if you know your geography of the tropics, your geography of Africa, you could see that the risk for this season seems to increase where you got mountains. The islands of Ethiopia, west of Kenya, bits of Madagascar, central Angola. Not really true for South Africa, it's quite flat there. Okay, so risk of malaria seems to increase into the future, theoretically, into altitude regions, in particular of eastern and southern Africa. But the risk is going down over Brazil, South America, and the Sahel, because the temperature gets so warm into the future in our model, the stimulation, that you start killing the mosquitoes. It's like basically you're sending lots of polar bears into the Sahara. Not going to survive very long. So it's a way to see it, okay? But that's, so basically, you could have like a nonlinear effect. You could create, let's say, a decrease in the risk, but it's going to create problems for other things. Knowing that here is a bit complicated, I've used the matrix. So there's different ensemble technique. We use different mathematical models for malaria, different climate models, different emission scenarios. And one map here synthesizes 25 members in different colors. More recent exercise with the others, so Felipe, Colin Gonzalez, Rachel Lowe, Adrian Tompkins, others, Joachim Rocklove involved in the exercise, where we looked at malaria and dengue scenarios. We found similar findings, but this time we had the new SEMIP6, so the new IPCC framework, which is a bit better because you got new population scenario coupled with new climate scenarios. You can look things on a two-dimensional way, so you've got the demographics on top. And we're showing similar things, increase over tropical latitude regions, temperature fringes. We had some dengue increasing to increase in the lowlands in the Western Pacific and IMRO region, which is one of the WHO region, which is important to us. And we had this weird thing. The risk was increasing more into rural areas, but dengue is very urban now. It's a very urban disease because the mosquito is very adapted to us. Okay, so that's a bit counterintuitive. To get back to my, it gets too warm, it gets too cold, things die, or things decreases. As an example for all the different models we were using, it's a bit theoretical and dengue models. And you can see that up to a certain point, you've got the risk increasing in the mild, let's say, fringes, but when it gets too warm, here, in the x-axis, temperature on the x-axis, rainfall on the y-axis, that's where things decreases. I won't have much time, but I think the other talks show you some of the examples. There's several vector-borne diseases I could talk about. I could talk about it for an hour. Some people have been anticipating the spread of Ixodes capillaris into northern Canada 10 years or 15 years ago. It's been written black and white in scientific papers before it occurred. It's the work by Nick Ogden in Canada. You can see also in some regions what I was talking about just before, pure field observation, tsetse flies in Zimbabwe, in a site where no field control, no spraying, nothing happened. And we think that the population started crashing that region because of the temperature going up. There's strong evidence there. Or things moving also into the Arctic, in northern Russia, in more, let's say, pre-Arctic, Arctic regions. There's a lot on that. Camille Parmesan has done a lot of this. Susan Kirst in America, there's lots of papers you can look at. On parasites, on deers or musk, I can't remember how they're called. And I wrote a review paper, if you're interested, there's lots in the literature about ticks, flies, midges, mosquitoes, and they're moving up at the minute in altitude, and they're moving a bit in latitude. That's a short summary. As conclusion, so I've talked about all those things. I think, so I'm going to skip quickly. Something I wanted to, just final thought, so I've been invited to work. I've been invited to work and have some ideas. So I'm trying to draft some ideas yesterday. But I think something I missed on, just reflecting on all the past 10 or 15 years, because we've been doing the work, we've been doing the science, we've been communicating it, but obviously you have to be critical about your work, what you've been doing, what you should be aiming for. Something I think we could improve, and I think Chris has been progressing, there's groups, other groups in America and other groups elsewhere who progressed a lot on those, is vulnerability. So basically, instead of saying the risk is going up or down in this region, there, there, and there, you need to also target the most vulnerable population. Yeah, it's going to go up or down in those clusters. That's very important. This way you tailor your risk. And I was very critical for the COVID pandemic, if you saw about it, what people have been doing operationally during the pandemic. You need to attribute and detect, so it's a complex exercise because the health data is uneven. It's difficult to put your hands on very long time series, very long time scales, data. So when you do the statistics, it's quite tricky, okay? If you want to know what malaria was about in the 1800s, you're gonna have to go through history books. It's a different matter. You're gonna have some proxies, but you won't have the same variables that you got now with modern medicine. So it's complicated, but there's some progress on that in the new IPCC exercise. I'm gonna quote Brian O'Neill, so he's part of the team that designed the RCPSSP framework for the IPCC. And I saw him giving a talk in a workshop 2 weeks ago. And he basically said that the IPCC, the climate community, got this SEMIP thing, which is where every climate modeler is going to draw up climate models. They put their experiments, everybody compare them. And then it crystallized into the IPCC report that you see in the news. But there's very little done on the impact side. It's quite patchy, people doing their work in different places. For agriculture, tourism, health, everything. So I was involved in this ISME project led by the German in Potsdam. They're doing a fantastic work trying to do this. But I think maybe the IPCC is going to have to move on those two. Basically, impacts, trying to get everybody sharing the data. So there's a lot to do there. Something we failed to is to tailor our data for the economists. I've been asked by the World Bank, by several economists in America, all over the globe, like, where is the data? Can you send me the data in that form for my country or this district or this county? Sometimes we don't do it like this. We play with our data format that's not really appropriate for them. So we need to think about that too, because everything has a cost, and for governments, very important. So that's something we need to improve. There's also the fact that we always do these long-term scenarios, okay, and do these long-term projections, but you see climate change is happening now. I mean, it's going to be 40 degrees in my hometown on Friday or Saturday. It's quite a lot. So, and the NGOs and the governments, or international agencies, or the UN-based agencies, they like to know what's going to happen in the 5-10 years, so something we need to think about too. We need to, instead of setting scenarios for the 2080s or the 2070s, when I'll be dead, very likely, we need to think about something more operational and seasonal. I won't pretend, I mean, that's, I don't know why I was quoting Bill Gates' ideas there, comes from another talk, but I think he's got some good ideas, I know that. About pandemics is different, because you've got zoonotic diseases, different transmission modes, but I think he's spot on many things, and I think we need to develop those tools, as I said. They could be useful, they're not perfect, but they can be used by public health services or those other people. We need to improve our food. It's going to be very challenging because the food, health, climate nexus is all interconnected, and Dirk talked about that, and many people talked about that. If you're healthy and well-fed, if you get infected, you're more resilient to infection, so that's key. And we don't forget also the diseases that are not really up on the agenda, because sometimes you see you focus on one disease, you focus on malaria, or you focus on dengue, and you don't focus on MERS, SARS, and then COVID comes, or you don't focus on disease Y or Z. So that's something we need to, NTD is still important, and other pathogens, or pathogen X, as the WHO says, is important. And then we need to train the next generation, so that's very important, I think. And we try to, in a multidisciplinary type of way, because they're very complicated problems, you need to know things about climate, environment, biology, animal health, so vets, the veterinary people are important, the entomologists, the field people. It's very complicated, it takes time. It doesn't take 5 minutes to train people at that pace. Because the next generation is going to be facing problems. So that's going to be very important. And that's my final slide, I'm sorry. Finish on, yeah, the picture is paper by Colin Carson, I quite liked, came out recently, showing where things could come from in terms of spillovers. You can argue, disagree with the modeling, but I think it was quite interesting. Well, basically, this next pandemic could come from there. Well, you see a risk in Europe as well. So I think this paper is interesting. The modeling was quite interesting. And it also echoes what been published by Kate Jones, UCL, a long time ago. So, and then basically you'll see also that the risk is where humans are, okay? So the more the people, the more the problem, usually. Yeah. And I thank you for your attention, sorry.